is Alaskan Legislative Review. Previously, Alaskan Legislative Review has featured faculty and staff from the University of Alaska Fairbanks talking about issues and problems facing the state of Alaska. Now that the legislature has adjourned, we have turned our attention to interviewing the members of the Interior Delegation to the Alaska State Legislature. Our guest today is Representative John Ringstad. Representative Ringstad was elected to the House of Representatives in the November election, 1982. He is a Republican serving in Seat B, District 20, from Fairbanks. Representative Ringstad is a graduate of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks and is a native Fairbanksan. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off by saying welcome to the show. I'm really glad you could make it. We've really enjoyed our interviews with legislators, and I guess I'd like to start off by saying, how does it feel to be home?
Well, it's real nice to be back. We stayed there a little too long this year, I think, and that makes it even more enjoyable getting back.
It was the second longest session on record, and when you were elected to office, you and several other members of the Interior Delegation became members of the House Majority Coalition in the House of Representatives. Could you explain to us a little bit about why you chose to join that organization?
Well, the organization, for the most part, is put together by people generally of the same philosophical background, looking at conservative, mostly fiscally conservative, ideas, trying to get some of the government bureaucracy out of the way, helping business so they can get out and create some jobs, going that general direction. There's also some distinct advantages in being in the leadership, in the majority. You have the ability to produce a whole lot more for your districts. I think with four of us from the Interior and the House being in the majority coalition, we did real well this year in getting legislation and money for the Interior, and that was a big part of it.
Now, you jointly co-chaired the House Resources Committee. Do you have a particular interest in resource issues?
Yes, I do. Resources have always been an area of interest for me. They're also a very important area to the Interior. We have a lot of mining. We've got a lot of resources, whether it be the mining, some timber, whole variety of things, the fish and game, and with that being such a major part of the state, I felt that was something that was important to us, and my position as co-chairing that committee allowed us a lot of input into that.
Now, what bills did you sponsor that passed this year?
I didn't sponsor myself very many bills. I think I only put in four. Two were the university's land transfer bills. They were identical bills that were put in on the Senate side that Senator Fahrenkamp put in, and we used her bills as the vehicles to actually complete the bill, and that was in an agreement that with her that I agreed to use her bill. So those didn't pass by design.
Right.
I introduced a bill for the fur farmers in the state, which surprisingly there's a larger number of fur farmers than expected, and they had, I guess it was your classic story of bureaucracy that was killing these people trying to run their operations. They had three agencies that they had to answer to, and none of the three really seemed to want to deal with it. So they got a lot of bureaucratic runaround, and the intent there was just to clean those up, get them under one agency, and so that people could go out and expand and do a good job of their business. That bill I did get passed, and it was a good one, and they seem real pleased with it.
And do you expect the governor to sign the bill, or
he signed it before we left Juneau?
Oh well, very good. So as a freshman, you did get some legislation passed,
yes,
which is no small accomplishment for any freshman.
Yes, I was pleased with that. I felt, you know, rather than introducing a lot of bills, most of the subjects are there. I don't particularly care if it's my bill that passes. All I want is to get the job done. And along that line of thinking, I mostly worked the other bills that were in the process rather than introducing them. There's, you know, like I said, I introduced four and got one of mine passed and two identical bills to mine passed, so I felt I did real well with it.
All right. Let's talk about resources for a minute. A bill that started out rather innocuously but toward the end of the session became quite controversial was Senate Bill 108, also sponsored by Senator Fahrenkamp, establishing a Tanana Valley State Forest. And in your role as chair, co-chair of the House Resources Committee, that bill, the Committee of First Referral in the House, was your committee. What's your side of the story? Why did the bill become such a controversy toward the end of the session?
Well, I guess a couple of reasons. One is that there's a large block of people in the state, and there's a number of them in the legislature that are philosophically against state owning land. They prefer to have the land from the state going into private hands. Once we classify the lands and put it into a category of state forest for perpetual management as that, that land will never go into private ownership. And that bothers a lot of people. The reason it became such a controversial issue, the way I saw it, was that there was a strong block of people that wanted a state forest bill, and there was a strong block of people that did not want it. And neither side wanted a compromise. They both wanted all or nothing. So rather than trying to work out a settlement and agreement to have a compromise bill, they just fought against each other. I think what we try to do is work out something in the middle. Politics and democracy is designed to be that way, as a compromise. However, it was real difficult to force the sides to want to agree to something in the middle.
It seemed funny that it would the bill more or less breezed along all session long, and then toward the final weeks, we started seeing the public signs of this opposition to it, and we found that it passed the Senate fairly handily, but when it came to your committee, some substantial changes were made. Could you talk about those changes?
One of the difference between the House and the Senate is that the Senate is on land disposal issues, deals more with the area of with government controlling part of it and state forests, those sort of things. And the House, a lot of members of the House, are very much opposed to any kind of government control of the land. They want it all available for land disposals. That's why that sentiment not being seen in the Senate, and the Senate had the bill. The Senate passed the bill out in about April. So we did not have that piece of legislation to work on until April or May, end of April. And at that point, then the House members became concerned with it. So until the Senate passed it, we have no real reason to be dealing with it unless we want to push it as a priority. And it wasn't
our priority
in the House.
Yeah.
Some of the changes, there was, in my committee, there was a lot of changes that were proposed, and I took a number of those and combined them all into the bill, rewrote a draft of the bill. Interestingly enough, most of the changes weren't mine. They were for other members of the House, whereas there was one that took out several thousand acres out toward the Minnow Flats. Then a combination of several people took out several thousand acres along the highway so that it doesn't just butt up against the highway all the way down from Shaw Creek to Tok. Several different changes like that. There was a proposal amendment in to force Department of Natural Resources to dispose of land before they could get land into state forests. And it was a ratio of, I think, 1 acre of disposal for every five of state forests. Those went in, and they caused quite a stir. To a certain extent, at that point, we were trying to say, there is another side of this. There are other people that have other opinions. and put out the other bill. The end result of something like that will hopefully, you get two different versions, and at that point, people will compromise and have your bill in the middle. And as a result, most of those, or several of those changes, were taken back out, and there was more of a compromise made in the final version.
So as you reported the bill out to the House floor then, what were the substantial changes from the Senate bill?
Okay, when we reported it out, it didn't go to the House floor. It went to the Finance Committee next, which was changed again in the Finance Committee. The one was for the land disposal amendment that was put in. There was two or three of them that took out about 300,000 acres, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a couple of those that, going to the Finance Committee, were changed again. Then a couple of additional amendments were made again in the Rules Committee prior to going to the floor. Then in an effort of cleaning up the bill by the time we got it to the floor, we did have a floor amendment on it that came out to the final form. The amendment on the floor was an agreement between the House and the Senate as a compromise, rather than passing a bill, then trying to fight it out in conference committee at the end. We passed that bill about 4 hours prior to adjournment, at which point there wouldn't be much time for a conference committee. What we did is worked on it the night before till about 11:30, and again at 7:30 on Sunday morning to come up with that compromise prior to passing it on the floor.
Let me ask a similar question in a different way. Are you happy with the bill, and is Senator Fahrenkamp happy with the bill? Did the compromises well, never leave everyone completely happy, but it should leave almost everyone kind of happy.
That's well put. Nobody got everything they wanted. So you're not totally enthused about it. On the other side, it's something that wasn't all bad either, so it's something you can live with. So I felt that it was a fairly good compromise, and I think Senator Fahrenkamp did too.
All right, the philosophical issues aside of the difference regarding should the state have land under its control for disposal or not, do you think the bill will be a good bill for the interior? What do you see? What kind of benefits do you see accruing to your constituents from the bill?
I think the concept of the state forest is a good one in that it requires multiple use. It's just not there to be a forest to be looked at. It's designed so that they can, if there's rich minerals in a particular area, that area can be opened up to mining. They'll go and sell the timber, go in and mine it. At some point in time, that area will be mined out, whether it be 5 years or 20 years, wherever. At that point, they'll put it back into the forest and revegetate it. With the cycle for the forest being near 100 years, 10 years at one point or another is a relatively short period of time. So it's combining the uses. It also allows a timber base for the timber industry. We've got several timber companies around here cutting timber, producing lumber. We've got a lot of people out using for firewood also. So it provides a good base for all that industry too. It's still open for hunting and fishing and those kind of uses, recreation, camping, that sort of thing too. So it's a good combination. Now we have to get a good management plan and see to it that access is for all uses is provided.
Does the bill, as I understand it, also establishes a state forest system, with the Tanana Valley State Forest being the initial forest? Is that correct?
That's correct. Essentially, the bill had two parts. One, it set up this type of multiple-use forest systems. The second half made this particular forest.
So is it possible we'll see in the future in, say, the Kenai or Southeast on state-owned lands establishment of state forests?
Yes, it is. That possibility has always been there. What this did essentially is redesign that to the multiple use concept. Rather than just having a state forest that you can't do anything with except maybe cut trees, it kind of takes that that approach away and puts in the multiple use so that we don't isolate our land and just lock it up for one use. They keep it available for multiple uses.
All right. Well, the impression I get is that this bill required a great deal of work and compromise on the part of the Interior delegation. It sounds like it was a learning experience for you.
It was an awkward one to a certain extent for me because it was such a controversial issue. And the Interior delegation in Juneau works very well together. And it's rare that we find an issue that becomes very large that we aren't all together on, particularly a Fairbanks issue. And this one, where there was distinct differences in it, I think that for the difference of opinions and the difference of ideas, we came out fairly well.
All right. Speaking of differences of opinions and issues, let's talk about the joint session conflict and the role that the coalition played and that you played in what happened. On June 7th, the governor convened a joint session of the legislature, and there were 17 members from the House present and 23 were absent. All but one of those 23 were members of the House Majority Coalition, and you and Representative Bettesworth from Fairbanks were absent. We heard Representative Bettesworth on an earlier show explain his point of view regarding it, so I'd like to hear what you have to say.
It's unfortunate, I think, the way that the information on the joint session has gotten out. The impression has been given that the issue was over confirmations, where I don't feel that confirmations were the issue. Of all the 75 or so people that were to be confirmed, there was an outside chance that Norm Gorsuch, the Attorney General, may not have been confirmed. And there was a fairly good chance that the Board of Fisheries would not be confirmed. The Board of Fisheries, because there was seven people, there was no one from the Interior and no one from Anchorage, which was kind of lopsided representation. All the rest of the commissioners would have been confirmed, and I think Norm Gorsuch would have been confirmed too. The qualifications were not the issue. The House had been going along trying to work toward an adjournment. We wanted to get out early. We had designed a plan relatively early, I guess in relative terms, April or so, end of April, to pass House bills and Senate bills, a list of priorities that would at least be dealt with by the other half of the legislature. And as things went along, that just wasn't happening. And it became very apparent that our agreements weren't working out too well. And it appeared that the House was not getting what we felt was a fair shake in who was going to run the state. There was an awful lot of power being left with just a couple of particular senators. The President of the Senate sent a letter to Speaker of the House inviting a joint session on June 2nd, which is the normal procedure. They one sent the other letter. At the beginning of the legislative session, they had informally agreed to do confirmations long about the last week of the session. And the House had scheduled all our confirmation hearings to bring in the commissioners and the different appointees into the committees for the committee process, which by statute we're supposed to do, for the first week of June. So Speaker Hayes sent a letter back saying, well, we're right in the process of having hearings. Why don't we do it on the 10th? And at that point, I had several from my committee scheduled up through the 7th for these commissioners coming in. And the Senate wrote back and said, no, that won't work. We can't do that. And the governor also agreed and said, no, we have to have it on the 2nd. That's what, at that point, they were trying to force, and the governor was getting with the Senate, was trying to force the House to a session when we weren't ready to deal with the issue. Given 5 days, we would have been. They were trying to demand that we do it at a particular point in time. And in a democratic process, we shouldn't have any three or four people telling the legislature how to do things and when to do them. I'm not, you know, I don't care if it's the governor that does it or the president of the Senate or who the people are. You know, we shouldn't be having that much power in just a few hands. When the Senate refused to cooperate or try and compromise somewhere in there, the House at that point felt, well, we've passed a budget, we've passed session limit bills, we've passed a whole string of what we had felt were priorities. We dealt with these things and been done with them for a significant amount of time. And we felt rather than compromise the confirmation process of committee hearings and the democratic process, we would adjourn and say, no, we're not going to go along with this. At that point, the House did adjourn, which caused a problem. The governor, then wanting to get his confirmations in, was trying to figure out which way to go when the president of the Senate requested that the governor call a special or a joint session. And the way our legal people told us in the House was that the Constitution says you can have when you're not in session, you can call a special session, and when you are in session, you can call both bodies together in a joint session. Well, it was kind of a catch-22. The Senate was still in session, so they couldn't call a special session, and the House wasn't, so they couldn't call a joint session. The House, during that period of time, had gone to the Senate and said, look, we're still willing to come back and work if we can get a plan to adjourn. Schedule it all out, make some commitments that we're going to live by. Every time we got close to something like this, we found out that it didn't appear that the Senate was going to hold up their end of the deal, so we said, no, we're not going to do it. At that point, the governor called a special session, or the joint session, which we felt was illegally called, and then you've got the governor telling the legislature what to do, which I feel is a real bad precedent. If you read the minutes of the Constitutional Convention, it states very specifically in there that the legislature is the supreme elected body in the state of Alaska, and that we are not there to answer to the governor. The governor is the administration. He administers the policies that the legislature puts out.
Granted that our governor has quite a bit of power to check the power of the legislature on his
correct,
own.
Correct, correct. We have the most powerful governor in the United States, I think.
Yeah.
But for the legislature to just do what he wants, when he wants, the way he wants, is giving him more power. At that point in time, we're looking at it saying, why have a legislature? You know, and there's a major precedent here. You know, when you're not looking at, you know, we're not even discussing the qualifications of these appointees. That was not the issue at all. I think that they badly overstepped their boundaries. We agreed to go back in, and even after we did come back to work a week later, we still agreed to go back into a joint session and have confirmations. But again, there was not a cooperation, there was not a compromise in there that they were willing to give.
So you're painting the picture in terms of the House basically was standing by its guns. It had an agenda, it had a given number of things it wanted to accomplish, and seemed to be willing to compromise with the Senate in terms of what the Senate's priorities and the governor's priorities were. And somehow, toward the end, the whole process of getting together and compromising on these things failed, and the governor and the Senate acted in their best light to try and get the House to come along. And what you're saying, the constitutional issue seems very critical here, and I'm sure it'll have to be decided in court, which I understand is what the coalition is pursuing. Is that
right.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty close. You know, with the court case issue, a lot of people are complaining because the House has decided to spend the money to do it. Well, in a young state, we've got a lot of these things that have to be decided in the court, like you say, and until such time as that happens, we'll never know. And rather than wait and have
several independent citizens who run into a problem because of this, individually wind up suing the state over this and clouding all kinds of different issues. We feel it is the state's duty to solve that problem. It is a constitutional legal question that has arisen, and I think it's a very, very valid one, and I think I've talked to people on both sides of the issue that agree that it is right that the state go ahead and solve it, get the courts to tell us what's right.
Well, we're all going to be looking forward to that decision. It'll be very interesting, and as you say, there are a large number of people on both sides of the issue. A big contrast, a dramatic contrast to the joint session crisis came about in the last days of the session when the legislature voted itself a very large pay increase, having substantial benefits for legislators, both in terms of pay and retirement. You and your coalition voted for that pay raise. In fact, it probably would not have passed had not the coalition voted for it. As I've asked all the other legislators, I'd like to ask you why you voted for, or well, I know how you voted, why you voted for it, and we've got about 3 minutes left, so.
Let me see if I can do a quick explanation of the pay rate situation. It's interesting that of all the controversial issues we dealt with, this is the one I'm hearing most about. And I think a lot of misleading information has been out there. One of the things I noticed last year campaigning is that very, very few people know what legislators were getting paid. And part of the reason for that is that we get a salary, or we used to get a salary of $20,000 a year, plus per diem. And nobody knew what that was. Now, well, on that note, the numbers I've recently received, the average income to legislators last year was $37,000.
That includes the per diem and expenses?
Right.
And, okay.
Okay, with that, the per diem, which anywhere from $12,000 to $20,000 is non-taxable. So that's valuable income to us because you don't have to pay income taxes, you're in a lot lower tax bracket. So you take the 37 and you make it taxable, and it's pretty close to the equivalent to the 46 anyway. We've had several of us have already been told by our accountants that it's going to cost us money in taxes. So we're in effect going to be losing money almost rather than getting a pay raise. I feel at least now we're being honest. The public now knows what we are getting paid. A year ago, nobody knew. At least we're admitting it. We're not trying to hide and have all kinds of different sources of income and money coming from the other areas.
All right. John, could you anything to wrap up?
Well,
a final impression of the session? Or?
I think it was a long and difficult one for a combination of reasons. We had a lot of new people, a lot of new administration people. We had a few controversial issues. I think all in all, it went fairly well, considering we were there so long and the troubles we had. We did get some good legislation out, and I think we're looking for a more optimistic and a better session next year.
All right. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
This has been Alaskan Legislative Review. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of KUAC FM at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Our executive producer is Carla Canella. Thank you.